Hey, discerned listeners, it's time to continue watching the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. Let's watch.
And you're a clinical psychologist, is that correct?
Correct.
And you practice in Los Angeles?
Yes.
For how long have you been practicing?
Almost 40 years.
So we're hearing from Dr. Anderson, a psychologist, clinical psychologist practicing in Los Angeles for the past 40 years.
A full 3.5 or not, I don't know. But that was the amount of, that was when the session started. And they came in when they came in and not together. And it took 3.5 hours to actually do that first session.
Okay, so Dr. Anderson worked with both Johnny Depp and Amber Heard in couple counseling or therapy. And the first session was 3.5 hours. I'm unsure as to why that would be. Some therapists, especially in an intake, especially with a couple, might actually allocate more time because you need more time to assess and to orient people to therapy. In fact, in the old days, couple therapy, at least anecdotally, standard was 90 minutes because 55 minutes or 50 minutes wasn't enough time. I will say that that makes a lot of sense. I still, with my couples, work for 50-minute sessions and find that it works for the most part. But anyway, so she said that they showed up when they showed up, and that's how long it took.
So as I understand it, for that first session, Mr. Depp and Amber Heard did not come in together?
I don't believe that they did. The next session with Amber, with Ms. Heard alone.
Okay, right away. I know some of you are clinicians, so I don't know if you picked up on this, but it should be clear in her notes what happened, because it would be unusual for you to engage in the first session with a couple and have them show up at different times or have them not be in the same room. I mean, and she doesn't remember. Well, of course she doesn't remember because it was 7 years ago. But that's why it needs to be in your notes, because that's a pretty important detail. It wouldn't be that hard to mention, right? Johnny Depp showed up 15 minutes late without Amber Heard. I talked with them briefly about, do they really want to meet without their partner? Johnny said yes, so I met with him, thinking that Amber Heard was, you know, like, that could be a flashpoint for a complaint or some need for clarification, and you should mention that. Or you should just refuse to meet with people. And I tell my trainees to do this, and particularly in the beginning of your career, and she's obviously not the beginning of her career, but you can be intimidated. You know, one person, it's not uncommon in couples therapy for one person just to show up at the office and say, you know, my spouse isn't coming today, or I think my spouse is coming soon. Well, under a lot of circumstances, like a different service, if you were a florist, for example, you'd say, okay, you know, come on in. But in therapy, we have all these ethical considerations and treatment considerations as to how to proceed. And unless you know that it's okay, you usually want to just say, well, wait in my waiting room and until both of you arrive, and then go ahead and come on in when both of you are here. Or if they just say they show up and the other person isn't coming, in all likelihood, you probably should say, oh, well, then we can't have the session because we hadn't talked about changing the treatment plan, which this would be a change. It would be me meeting individually with you. Now, you can absolutely work that into a treatment plan. In fact, it is part of a lot of people's protocol that they follow all the time, which is that you meet as a couple and then you meet individual with each person and then back as a couple and maybe alternate or have some sort of configuration around it. So nothing wrong with that, but you can't have things just randomly happen. You don't know how the other person feels about it. You don't know what they're going to tell you. You know, there's just a lot of things you have to work out in the beginning. But anyway, so right off the bat, I'm thinking, so you have a vague understanding of maybe they didn't show up at the same time. There's this 3.5 hour block of time, and it's not clearly discussed in your notes. I don't know what that means.
For background intake, and that was a 2 1/3 hour session.
And that session was on October 6, 2015?
Yes.
And what's the next row indicate?
So I have no idea. Dr. Anderson isn't here to answer questions, so I can't know. But if I heard this from one of my supervisees, I would say, why are your sessions so oddly timed? Your first session was 3.5 hours. Your second session was 2 hours and 20 minutes. What's going on there? And if they said, well, we actually scheduled that because this and that, or they said, I, with couples, like to have a little bit of flexibility with my time, and I have that in my disclosure statement. Here is my justification for that. I account for the risks of breaking the frame. Because one of the things that therapists will do at times, unfortunately, is particularly if it's their last client, they'll just kind of go along if they feel like it. And under some circumstances, that's absolutely considered ethical and important for treatment. For example, I had a family that I was treating that had one of the children died tragically the day before, and we just randomly had a family therapy session. And normally it would be an hour, but since it was such an important session, it went like 3 or 4 hours long. Because, and I had the luxury of doing that. I didn't have other clients right after. So I adjusted on the fly. But that's a pretty, you know, particular circumstance. And the reason why we want to have standards around this is because there's a lot of reasons. But one is just your own time. Because if you do that flexibility thing with all your clients, you'll have no free time. And you won't be able to charge for it as well because you didn't talk about it up front. But the other thing is that if you go long one time, and then the next time the client hopes you're gonna go long, but you don't go long and you hold fast to the boundary, then what message are you telling the client? Are you telling them that you don't like them anymore? Are you telling them they're not worth it? Are you telling them that they weren't interesting enough? And you don't want to do that, right? You don't want to have that kind of squishiness around what sort of, and some clients will be fine. They won't be susceptible to the paranoia around that, but many clients will. And so you want to avoid that. Or if they hear about another, you know, because sometimes clients know each other. And if they heard that their friend got to go 2 hours, but you always only get to go one, then how does that make you feel? One, you could feel ripped off because you're paying the same price, but you're getting half of the service. So you just want to, we call it the frame of therapy, meaning the boundaries, the structure. You want to be very careful about being loose with that. Now, for her, I don't know what it means. She has an agreement, or she has a whole ethical set of guidelines that she follows regarding her session time. But I will say that it wouldn't be uncommon for a therapist to be working with a high profile individual, whether they're super famous or super rich or something, to break the frame. You know, we heard Dr. Curry talk about how she has never gone to a client's house and had dinner and drinks, you know, but she never even went to the house of the individual in question when she's doing forensic psychology, but with Johnny Depp, she did. And why? Well, because he's rich and famous. And I think she literally said as much. And why would you do that? You know, another client hears about that. They're like, well, why am I not getting that treatment? I have to go into the office. And it raises questions of bias and your own professionalism. So you just don't want to have that. It's not necessary. And you don't want to have to answer those questions. And if you do it, then make sure you could literally even write in your notes, I went long today because I thought that it would be important because of the issues that were being presented, something like that. You wouldn't want to do that a lot, but without any sort of explanation or justification, it raises questions.
You saw Amber on October 6, 2015 for 2 1/3 hours, correct?
Yes.
And what is the next row indicating?
The next day, October 7th, Mr. Depp for 3 1/2. Again, it may not have been face-to-face for the full 3 1/2, but it was being at the beginning of the session, waiting for him, his coming in with the entourage and our getting to work.
Again, it should be in there, the notes. Unless it's just like par for the course for her, that she just blocks out 3 1/2 hours. And because, you know, it'd be important. What if the client was only there for the final half an hour and the things you worked on looked like it was longer or looked like it was super short? It's like, well, you had 3 1/2 hours. So, you know, you should document that. But yeah, again, who knows? Maybe she's all buttoned up and she has a whole system and it would make sense to me. But if I heard of a trainee doing this, I would really drill down on it. I'd be like, why are you doing that? So 3 1/2 hours, I don't know when he showed up. So, and the other thing is, and maybe there was, but given the signs of issues, that did Johnny Depp show up? Was that the plan? Or was it kind of random that he just randomly showed up, because in couple therapy, often they're in conflict, and one person will say, I'm not going to therapy today. And the other person will be like, well, I am going. And then one person shows up at your door, and you have not pre-discussed that with the other client. And there are, again, there are a lot of issues with that.
On the 1024 row, next to the 2 hours, it says W out, correct?
Walk. For me, that's walk out.
And do you recall who walked out of that meeting?
I have tried to, and I don't, because each threatened and stood up, and I'm not positive who finally did the walkout.
Okay, this is another pet peeve of mine. This is presumably the official document for the session, and she's using abbreviations, W out. I don't know, maybe they're referring to her psychotherapy notes, in which case all bets are off. You can write whatever you want to in those notes for the most part and use your own notations for sure. But if you're writing a medical record that is going to be read by other people, potentially, then it should be at least understandable to another clinician. And W out, and I'm just going to say, from my opinion, is not a standard abbreviation for walked out of the session. Two, it should say who walked out. It's just the, it's a, it's, and the other, that's what I also tell my trainees, because when I look at their notes sometimes, I'm like, how come you're not using full sentence? I feel like some, well, one, it's hard because you don't have a lot of time, which I get, but that's not an excuse. Two, I find some trainees will, and really veteran therapists, will have this weird way of talking in their notes, because I think they are trying to come across as technical. They're trying to make it seem like they're more professional than they feel on the inside. And I'll say, why are you writing so strangely? You know, therapist said, it's like, just say me. You're the one writing the note. Everyone understands, if you sign it at the bottom, everyone understands the I is you. I ask, because when you say therapist, was there another therapist in the room? Because there could have been. Anyway, so you would want to say, so-and-so walked out of the session, that kind of thing. I'm going back in time rewatching this section. I've already watched the Dr. Hughes testimony, which referred to Dr. Anderson as having had four sessions, but we're learning that there were two more sessions that were individual. And we heard that Johnny Depp had walked out from the session. And the way Dr. Hughes characterized it, I believe, was he stormed out or something. But from Dr. Anderson's description, they were both accusing each other or being aggressive, yelling at each other. And then Johnny was the one who walked out, which is very consistent with other accounts, that they would have high conflict, high conflict, high conflict, and then he would separate as a way of trying to stop the conflict. We even heard Johnny and Amber talking about that in that private recording, in which he was saying, I was trying to get away or something like that. And she was saying, oh, you know, you're so noble or something like that. You're so commendable, admirable for walking away. Good for you, you know, ridiculing him, that guy. So, you know, what does that say? I think to a lot of people, and maybe to the jury, that indicates that Johnny Depp, at least in those instances, especially if he has a pattern of that, is not the abuser, because he's willing to put an end to it. He's trying to get away, and she is not, by according to the pattern. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, but anyway.
What does it say? What is it indicating on the row for 11-12?
Couple session showed 1.5 hours.
And then on 12-17, what does that show?
Amber alone showed 2.25 hours.
She had another individual session with Amber. And the way she's reading her notes, it says Amber showed. I think that means that it was scheduled to be for the two of them, but one of them just happened to have shown up. And it's not a strong indication of a problem, but it's a red flag. Again, if I had a trainee that did that, I would really make sure that they were justifying that to me. In fact, I would tell trainees, you can't, under my supervision, you can't just treat one person unless it's an emergency. You know, if one person showed up and said, my partner is having a really hard time, they're really depressed, and I just need to talk with you about maybe, you know, some, so what can I do? Okay, you know, there's some circumstances, but high conflict couples will often do this. They'll kind of play, I don't know if it's games, but well, games with each other of, I'm not going to therapy with you today or something like that. And it's like, you don't want to be a part of that. It's like, okay, I get it. Work it out or don't, but come in together. Or we'll schedule two different individual sessions, you know, because usually you want, especially in the beginning, you want some parity there. You want a balance. You don't want to meet only with one person alone and not the other. Sometimes that's justified and sometimes that might be necessary. And again, maybe there's a full explanation of all this stuff, but there's just a lot of red flags of breaking the frame.
So it's a one-page email. So let me know when you're finished.
Okay, so this is an email prior to Dr. Anderson working with Johnny Depp and Amber Heard from, I think, someone named Christian or Christina, I can't really tell, saying that my closest friend Amber wants to come see you alone at first and then with her husband Johnny. Dr. Anderson replies and says, I have openings, da-da-da, you know, we'll talk about it. So I get this request sometimes. It's not super common, but it happens sometimes. And when I hear that, when someone says, I want to engage in couple therapy, but I want to come in first, and then my partner and I will come in, it's a huge red flag that, one, the individual calling me is trying to control the situation. It's not always that, but you know, you can imagine that they want to come in and win me over or something, or get me on their side prior to meeting the other person, or they're trying to warn me that their partner can be very charismatic or something and convincing. And I just want to say, I know how to detect that sort of thing, so you don't have to worry about it. But there's a huge problem with that. If that happens, I don't know if the other person even wants to be in therapy because I haven't even communicated with that person. But let's say that I did know, and then the one member comes in. Well, the second session with the couple, the person left out is already at a disadvantage, and I have to do a lot of extra work to get them to trust me, right? Whereas if everyone just shows up at the first session, then everyone's on an equal footing. And we might have breakout sessions from there individually, but everyone starts at the same place. No one else will feel like they're ahead. Now, I will say that occasionally, under circumstance that I can't control, that will happen where I'll just see one person and then later other people will join in couple therapy or in family therapy. And I can manage. The worry mainly is that clients are going to think that I am biased. But I've been around the block enough times to, you know that if one person comes to my office and tries to get me on their side, I'm not going to give in on that. You know, I'm going to reserve judgment, if you will, until I meet the person. But anyway, so I don't know why they're bringing up this email, though.
This is not infrequent that I might get an email like this. So, and when I hear that someone may then later want to come in with their husband or spouse, yes, I think it has to do with relationship issue.
On September 9th, 2015, you received an email from Mr. Carino, is that right?
Yes, apparently. He was trying to set it up.
And Mr. Carino was trying to set up a meeting with you and Amber and Mr. Depp, is that right?
Yes, that's what I assumed.
So this isn't a huge deal, but whenever anyone contacts me on behalf of other people, I always say, well, okay, good, you brokered us to meet, but have the other person contact me to schedule. I never want to work through someone else because I don't have a positive confirmation that they want to work with me. Plus, I want to get that party, that third party, out of the picture as soon as possible because they are potentially encroaching on the confidentiality of one or both of the individuals that will come in. And so, I say, you know, thanks. And when have those people contact me. It's also a test to see if those individuals actually want therapy. Like a common scenario would be a parent would call me and say, you know, I want my teenage son to work with you. And in the beginning, I would accept those cases and either the teenager would show up and just sit like a lump on a log on my couch, which is, I'd tell you, one of the worst clinical experiences. I'd rather have someone yell at me than just sit there. I mean, I've had in the beginning of my career, you know, you take what you can get because you got to pay your bills. Later on, I would never stand for literally like 2 minutes of being like, yeah, out of my office. If you're not going to participate, I want to work. You know, no offense, kid. Clearly, someone is forcing you into my office, but I'm not going to play this game. So, you know, God bless you. You could probably find another therapist that will sit with you while you stare at the ground and not. And I'm not talking about people that are depressed or shy. I'm talking about people that are defiant and they don't want to be there. So, but in the beginning of my career, I had to take what I could get. And I'll never forget this one client would repeatedly lay on my couch and act like he was sleeping the entire, and he might have been sleeping. And I'd just sit there and watch the seconds tick by. I mean, just imagine that, right? You can't do anything. And this is before like cell phones or anything. So it's not like I could flip through something and entertain myself. I'm just sitting there. Yeah, pretty rough. So that's one scenario. And I tell the parents, well, if the kid wants therapy, have him contact me. It's a litmus test, because if that never happens, then I'm better off that they don't contact me. But if it does, then it means, oh, they do want to work with me, and I can actually begin on the right foot. Rather than someone being dragged in, it is someone voluntarily wanting to work with. So that's another reason why I won't do this. If someone is brokering, I'll be like, well, have them contact me. Now, one could argue that Dr. Anderson understood that Johnny Depp and Amber Heard are very important people, and they don't make their own appointments, maybe. I don't know. But even then, maybe even more of a reason that I personally would require that they reach out to me personally, because, you know, I wouldn't want to start as if they felt as though they were being kind of corralled into someone. I would want them to start saying, I want this. And I would also be, it would also be a litmus test, again, to see if they really wanted to work with me, but also it would be a litmus test to see if they could actually make their own appointments. Because the other thing is if someone, you can tell that I've dealt a lot of with the logistics and the fallout of not having the right measures in place in the beginning. So say that there's a situation where this person is sort of making the appointments for them. And then when they come in, it's possible that they don't really even know how to keep track of their own schedule unless someone tells them what they're doing, and thus will not show up on time, will show up late, will show up without their partner. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's another litmus test of, can you make an appointment and keep it? Because if you can't, then it's going to be hard to do this. Now, if there's a clinical reason that I have some, you know, evidence for, some medication or have hints of, that prevents them from doing that, then of course I will make accommodations. But if it's just a famous person not invested in the couple therapy, then I frankly don't want to work with them.
I really appreciate it. I have to speak to my husband when he's done working today and make sure he's good with that time. I think it sounds perfect. Thank you so much again. I'm really looking forward to meeting you.
The other I didn't realize that this would just be me talking to fellow couple therapists out there about boundaries and ethics and the frame. But another thing that I do is, right off the bat, I do not communicate with just one person in the couple. I immediately ask for the other person's email address, and I will explicitly say, every email communication that you send to me, I will reply to both of you. There's exceptions to that, obviously, if someone disclosed something regarding safety, domestic violence, for example, intimate partner violence, then I absolutely would not, obviously. But as a couple therapist, you can get into some really hairy situations by giving the impression that someone has a direct private line to you via email. They could just drop a bomb like, hey, I just want to tell you I'm cheating on my husband over email. Don't tell him. Well, unless you have some sort of policy or way of dealing with this, and that just comes out of the blue, then you're in a really weird situation. So you just want to send this message. The other thing that it avoids is, in couple therapy with, you know, highly contentious couples such as these two, there's a minority of couples that will do this, it's not many, where they naturally, in between sessions, want to reach out to you, and will do so through what they believe to be a private line to you and say, oh, she's doing it again. You can't believe what, you couldn't imagine what she's doing right now. And you're like, what are you supposed to do with that, right? But if you have a policy that you say, I always reply all to the two of you, then the person won't necessarily do that, right? They have to wait until the session to talk about things, or they have to announce that they're telling the therapist that. You just don't want that kind of policy or that kind of message being given to people that they can have a direct line. And while I'm on this topic, because I don't get to talk about this very often, is a lot of younger therapists today actually will text with their clients. You know, it's a really easy way of scheduling this sort of thing, but it is a wide open door to problems. And I have worked with, you know, hundreds of trainees, and the vast majority of the time, in the beginning, for a while, the texting is fine. You know, because most clients don't, contrary to stereotype, most clients don't break boundaries. For example, I practice out of my home, and I have been practicing out of my home, my private practice, for 22 years. I've had a practice for 24 years or something, 25 years, but and I've been practicing for 26 years, but I have always, for 22 years, I've been operating my private practice out of my home. And currently, my practice is very small, but in the past, it was, you know, full time. And so, you know, Monday through Friday, there were several clients coming in and out of my house. And one of the things I'm sure that some of you are thinking, well, are you in danger? Are your clients going to kill you? And I'm like, do you go to therapy? Would you ever kill your therapist? I go to therapy. I would never show up to my therapist's house unannounced. So, and that's literally never happened. I've had hundreds of clients. Now, I work with a population that is not likely to do anything like that. So, you know, so if you worked with a different sort of population, you would take that into consideration. But the point is that clients don't usually break boundaries. It's pretty rare. So if you gave your work phone number, texting line to your client, most clients will not be inappropriate or be problematic around that. But some clients will. And when that happens, it's kind of a nightmare, because if you've given the impression that you are available essentially 24/7, because that's the impression with texting, right? Is that you will get that right away, especially if you've indicated that at some point, like you get a text and you at 9:30 at night and you text them back right away. Unless you give a heavy caveat to that whole thing, you've given the message that you are available 24/7. Again, most clients won't matter, but some it will. And so they just start texting you. And what are you supposed to do? Especially if they text you some kind of indication of, you know, danger in their life, you might actually be on the hook of actually responding at 4 a.m. because you actually gave the impression that you're available. And so almost all the time, if not all the time, my younger supervisees who will have that aspect of their practice, you know, they're just really used to texting, and they have younger clients who are really used to texting. And almost all the time, what will happen is we will run into a situation where a lot of weird things happen, and then the supervisee will say, I don't ever want to have texting again. I'm going to start a new policy. And then we write a whole policy where they have to communicate through the portal, the HIPAA compliant portal that people often will use. No more Gmail, no more any, you know, it's got to all be through that. And I'm going to give a strong message to all of them that I am not 24/7 because I'm not an on-call therapist. Anyway, so it's nothing to do with this trial, but let's get back to it. I'm going to stop lecturing my fellow clinicians.
And you wrote, hey, Christian, have of course avoided this my whole career unless someone was in rehab, would be willing to try it once. And that there's something I'd like Johnny to understand, and I don't think he does. Where you wrote, I'd like Johnny to understand, would be willing to try it once, in that there's something I'd like Johnny to understand that I don't think he does. What did you mean by that?
We're learning that this Christian individual is still brokering the appointments, which, I don't know, one could argue, given their fame and their really weird schedules and their very used to having assistants do all these things for them, maybe, but I personally would not go along with this. I would demand, I'd be like, no, you know, and maybe the first time I'd be like, so just let you know, from this point forward, the two of you have to make your appointment with me. If there's a hardship there that makes it extremely difficult or impossible, let's talk about it. But otherwise, I'm just going to take a guess and say that you're capable of scheduling with me. If you don't have an email address, call me. I'm sure you have a phone. So I would require that because of the issues I said earlier. We're also hearing that this Christian individual was asking if the therapist, Dr. Aniston, would do a house call. And just a little note on that. I've done a lot of in-home therapy. There was a chapter of my career, a good 10 years, where about, I don't know, half to a third of my clients were in-home. And the benefits are really great. Are one, the client always shows up. You know, when you're starting as a clinician, you have kind of a revolving door of new clients and clients who are terminating. I think somewhere the average length of therapy is something like 5 sessions or something, maybe even less. So, you know, this idea that somehow therapy is this long drawn out thing is just not normally the case. I mean, one, a lot of people come in for 1 or 2 sessions, the crisis abates and they don't go back. So it kind of skews that direction. But the point is that when you are just trying to get your practice off the ground, which can take 10, 15 years, you are really needing a new set of clients almost every week, or at least every month. And one of the reasons why you're also desperate to get clients is because some clients, they just don't even show. Now, of course, you can charge them, but you know that can be kind of tough for some people. You just charge them for not coming. And again, it's totally fine. And that's usually described in one's disclosure statement. But anyway, so in order to make money, you have to have sessions. So, you know, your car payment, your rent, your bills, everything depends on clients coming to see you. You're essentially a restaurant hoping that customers come in. Otherwise, you can't pay your bills and everything goes down the tube. So going to people's homes means that they are very likely to be there. So you can charge them instead of hoping that they show up to your office. So that's one selfish benefit. The other benefit is you get to have clients that are usually a lot more comfortable than they would be in your office, or at least they have a different vibe, right? Another benefit is that you get to observe their life a lot closer. You're not just watching them hang out, but you know, you can get a good sense of what someone and their life is like by being in their home. When I did family therapy in home, I would meet in the teenager's room because, you know, the whole family's there and I can't occupy the entire living room, kitchen area. So we would go into the teenager's room and seeing their room was very interesting. You know, I could really get a sense. I could also get a sense for pets because some families have extremely chaotic pet situations. You know, they have like 6 dogs and they're crapping everywhere. And there's all the barking and yelling and a lot of chaos. You wouldn't necessarily know that if they just came into your office. Other benefits is clients who could otherwise never go to therapy can have in-person therapy where maybe they have medical issues or they have 5 kids or that they're foster parents, a single foster parent, for example, would have a really hard time getting away. So those are benefits. You can also charge more because you're going to people's houses. The other thing, but there are a lot of disadvantages, right? One is that you are in their environment and thus have a harder time dictating the frame of therapy. In our offices, we can control things. If people can see in, if people can hear, if you're going to be interrupted, you know, by various different things. And you are very careful to make sure that no one can hear or no one can see inside and confidentiality is upheld, safety is upheld, the calm nature that therapy is upheld. Whereas you go to someone's house and God knows, you know, neighbors might be coming in and out, blah, blah, blah. So it's harder, but you have to, you know, wrangle it in. So I might say to the family, well, next time, can you make sure that someone's watching the dogs or something like that? But I will tell you this one time, I was doing in-home therapy and I'm a very distractible person. I don't have ADHD, but particularly if like a TV is on. And so I was meeting, it was just the mom and we're sitting at the dining table. There's no one else in the house. And over her shoulder is this gigantic TV just playing a random channel. And I am usually trying to be polite. So, you know, I'm talking to her. And I couldn't listen. I couldn't hear what she was, every other word she was saying, I kept being distracted by the TV. And so, and this would happen sometimes because some people I found, which is another clinical data point, just, they just want the TV on all the time. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that. It doesn't indicate something pathological, of course, but it is notable that someone would wake up in the morning, just turn the TV on, and whether they're watching it or not. Okay. And so she, I think, was one of those people. And so when I'd run into those people, I would have to ask to please turn off the TV. And they usually would. And I would always ask politely, which I did in this instance. And she did not take it well. She said, "How dare you? Don't tell me what to do. It's my television. This is my house." And I'm like, okay, totally. I mean, oh, yeah. I mean, it is your house. It is your TV. You don't have to turn it off. I was just asking out of courtesy because I'm having a hard time paying attention to you because right over your shoulder is this gigantic chaotic television. But okay, anyway, so, you know, and there are other issues too. Of course, safety comes to mind. You might be in a neighborhood that you're not familiar with, or you might be harmed by someone in the house. That almost never happened, although that did happen to a supervisee of mine once who was doing in-home therapy. But anyway, so she's being asked to do in-home therapy, which is totally fine. But again, you want to have a policy around that, a procedure, and you want to have conversations with clients, at the very least, with them as you are making that determination, not through a broker. We heard from her that she's saying she doesn't like to do that unless it's a case of rehab. And I don't know why that would be. Maybe because someone is detoxing or something, or really trying hard not to use so they're not ever leaving their house. And who knows? But she's saying she doesn't want to do that. But in this case, she will. So this is similar to Dr. Curry of like, I never do this, but for you, okay. How does that make sense? Now, if someone was, you know, like in hospice and they can't make it into your office, then fine, you know, that, but Johnny Depp and Amber Heard are able-bodied individuals who can make it to your office. Now, if there was an argument like, well, the paparazzi or something like that, well, okay. I'm sure they have ways of dealing with that though. So, but at the very least, you talk it out and you have a policy. You're like, well, because of this and this and this, I'm going to justify this. I'm going to put it in my notes. We're going to talk about it. I'm going to make sure that you understand that the only reason why I'm doing it is not because you're famous, but because of the hardship with paparazzi or whatever. So that's why I'm doing it. I just want to make sure. I'm going to charge a lot more, that kind of stuff. But anyway, so I don't know about Dr. Anderson, but I'm just, there's some issues that, again, if it was a trainee of mine, a supervisee, I would say, let's talk about the frame.
I can't say exactly what it was I wanted to impart, but I know that I thought that he was having difficulty in the sessions. And I think it was something about the process between the two of them that I was trying to clue him into.
What difficulty was Mr.
And this is communicating to a third party. Now, I would assume that she has a release of information signed by both of the clients, because Christian is not the client. Christian is what we call a collateral contact and not a fellow medical provider, therapy provider, which you could justify speaking with and not breaking confidentiality. You still want to check in with the clients about it, but, you know, just... I feel like I'm just hearing so many little things that are triggering me to talk about things that are very, very important to me and things that I have run into a lot in my own practice and learned the hard way myself, and also get extremely annoyed. Because when you're a supervisor like me of therapists, if they mess up, it's potentially your fault. So, you know, my supervisees are in private practice and have no other supervisors. I'm not even there because, you know, I have my practice and they're across town in their own practice. And you have to be very buttoned up and you don't want to get sued yourself as a supervisor. So there are certain guidelines that I have that I make my supervisees follow. And I'm hearing a lot of the classics that I will go, what's going on here?
Mr. Depp having in the sessions?
Having a voice.
What do you mean by that?
Ms. Heard had a jackhammer style of talking. She was very amped up. He had trouble talking at a similar pace.
Interesting. Dr. Anderson is saying that I was interested in a different style of session, perhaps in home, alone with him, because he was having trouble having a voice in couple therapy, because Amber Heard has a jackhammer style of talking where Johnny Depp was having a hard time keeping up with the pace. We could certainly imagine that given the private audio that we heard, and that, you know, it's interesting.
Their dialogue, he was cut off a lot. So I'm guessing this is what I was, I'm not sure what it is, but there was something, anyhow, this is how he didn't have a voice.
I don't know, maybe Dr. Anderson has a full understandable justification for taking that treatment decision to meet alone with Johnny Depp in his house to help him have a voice. I would not recommend someone do that. I would recommend that, one, if you were going to do that, you would ask Amber if that was okay. You'd be like, so I'm going to meet with your husband because I feel like he's having a harder time talking when you're around. And so I'm going to meet alone with him. Is that okay with you? You know, that kind of thing. But of course, the stronger recommendation, the more clinical route, is to address it in couple therapy, to say, hey, Amber, like, here's my observation of the way you communicate. And my observation is, I think it makes it hard, or it seems to make it hard for, or even better way to be like, okay, Amber, I'm going to talk to Johnny for a second. And I want to be able to go back and forth with him just for a couple minutes here without any kind of interruption. So is that okay? Okay. Johnny Depp, when we're in the session and the two of you are talking, how does that feel? Or how easy is it for you to get in a word in and that sort of thing? And then he says, well, it's kind of hard for me because I talk slower than she does. And okay, so Amber, does that make sense? Yeah, it actually bugs me that he talks slow. Okay, well, let's work on that, because if both people are going to have a voice, then I think we're going to have to make some adjustments. One, Johnny, you're going to have to speak up more. And I realize that's not very comfortable for you. And you might have to assert yourself. And Amber, you might have to slow down. And there might be times when I might actually prompt you to stop talking just for a little bit so that Johnny Depp can talk, Johnny can talk, because if we don't get a back and forth, then it might be real hard. And I know for you, Amber, that it gets real frustrating that he doesn't talk faster, but you know, we have time. You just lay that out. And that's a very, very common intervention that you will do early in therapy and might have to repeat as time goes on. I will say that as I develop a relationship with couples, all I have to do is be like, zip it. Because we have a strong relationship where I can say things like that and get away with it, you know. And so I'll just, you know, Dr. Evil, was it? You know, zip it. Nope. Or I might even just put up my hand, just like, you know, or a look like.
He couldn't keep up with her rapid fire way of conversation. And so he was really overwhelmed.
So if I were there coaching her prior to this deposition, if that's what they call it, I would say, and she told me this is how she's going to describe it, I would say, let's tone that down a little bit to something more observational, because that sounds like an opinion, rapid fire, jackhammer. And I will work with my trainees on this, because when they're right, it's more relevant to when they're writing in their notes that they will use this, what I might call more colloquial language and a more neutral, and you can think for yourself, like if you were to clinically describe jackhammer, rapid fire, overpowering, bulldozing communication, what would be a more clinical phrase? And again, it usually has to do with observation rather than some kind of metaphor. So I'll give you a second, or you can pause it. For me, at the top of my head, I would say that Amber exhibited a style of communication that was faster and more assertive than Johnny Depp. And Johnny, seemingly from my observation, I'm not quite sure, had a slower paced way of talking. And thus the net result of that was that it appeared to me that Johnny was having a hard time getting in his thoughts, because he would pause and then Amber would insert things, which is natural. You know, so that's a more neutral way of describing it, right? And perhaps a lot more accurate and less judgmental. If you are a couple therapist, you don't want to write or think or say phrases that is going to alienate someone. To call Amber a jackhammer, rapid fire, overwhelming communicator is, you know, it's going to alienate someone. So, and it also might mean that you're biased, that you have counter transference, which is very common in couple therapy. Couple therapy, in my experience, has by far the most counter transference on average, meaning that the therapist is most provoked emotionally and thus more likely to be biased.
Do you recall seeing photos from Amber Heard?
I have, but I don't remember when I saw them.
What do you recall about the photos?
Her face was bruised.
Do you recall where on her face you saw, on Amber's face you saw bruises?
I think they were around her eyes, but I couldn't be positive.
All right, so we're learning that she saw a picture of Amber with bruises around her eyes, and indicating that Johnny had inflicted those wounds. Okay. It makes me wonder why Dr. Hughes did not want to talk to Dr. Anderson and just looked at the notes. I don't know.
Both were victims of abuse in their homes, but I thought he had been well controlled for decades. And then with Ms. Heard, he was triggered and they engaged in what I saw as mutual abuse.
Oh, well, that's why I believe, who knows, Dr. Hughes, the Amber Heard forensic psychologist, didn't want to talk to Dr. Anderson, is because Dr. Anderson's opinion is that it was mutual abuse. And, you know, again, if I were on the jury and I heard that Dr. Hughes because, you know, there are a number of clinicians involved in the case available to talk with in person, and you only talked to those therapists that were on the record saying that Amber Heard was the victim and Johnny Depp was the perpetrator. Coincidentally, they were the individual therapists. Now, maybe I'm missing it. You know, maybe it's hard to keep track of all these names that Dr. Hughes did talk to Dr. Anderson, but from my memory, it was only Dr. Anderson's notes that Dr. Hughes looked at. But so according to the couple therapists. Now, when I heard during the Dr. Hughes testimony, which in the timeline happens after that, later than this, they said it was just four sessions. And I remember thinking like, well, just four sessions, you're not going to get much information. But she had actually seven sessions total with all of them. And the sessions were seemingly on average 2.5 hours. So yeah, that's like 25 sessions or something, or I don't know, whatever, how the math works out, like 18 or 20 sessions. So, I mean, that still doesn't necessarily mean she has more information, but that's a lot of data, right? To observe them actually talking to each other repeatedly over many weeks and many sessions, hearing their report and concluding that it's mutual abuse. So, you know, that says something, I think. And also, she's saying that according to her conceptualization, that Johnny Depp, they're both heavily abused growing up. And for Johnny Depp, he kept his violent side under control for 20, 30 years. But then with Amber, was triggered, particularly by her. Okay. I think that's very likely a sound conceptualization, given the limited information that I've received.
Sometimes. I know she led on more than one occasion and started it to keep him with her, because abandonment and having him leave was her worst nightmare.
Interesting. Yeah, I've talked about this, I believe, already in this series of reaction videos. I know I've talked about it a lot on this channel, that with preoccupied individuals, borderline individuals could be characterized as a sort of preoccupied attachment, anxious attachment. These individuals are terrified of losing their proximity emotionally and physically from their partners. They went through a lot of abandonment or separation growing up. And the separation can take very obvious forms, like abandonment by a parent, that you're going through a divorce, one parent just moves out of state and you never see that parent again. Or your parents are suffering from drug addiction and there's child neglect and you get taken away by Child Protective Services and you go into a foster home for a while. That is another attachment abandonment. Or you're being abused by a parent and it feels like an abandonment because there's an abandonment of attunement and closeness. And even though the parents are there all the time, the abuse takes the form emotionally as an abandonment for the individual. Anyway, so for these individuals with these relational traumas, they can often engage in high conflict relationships. And in those relationships, sometimes a common configuration is to be with someone that is at the very least more avoidant than they are, meaning that when push comes to shove, they want to separate. When push comes to shove for preoccupied people, they want to move in. So it can create this pursuer distancer situation, which often can result in, well, not often, but sometimes can result in abuse. Often abusive individuals are in a situation like this. And the avoidant person is more like, they're almost pathologically wanting to get out of conflict a lot faster. I don't know if we saw evidence of that in Johnny Depp, but at the very least, it looks like Amber, if she has borderline or she's on the spectrum, if this account is true, then in conflict, Johnny, given the way that he was growing up, the way his sister talks about how they would go into their room to escape, he would want to get away, which is often a good idea to take a break. These individuals need to tell the preoccupied person, I will be back, I'm not abandoning you. But often they don't, like 99.9% of the time, they just passive aggressively give the silent treatment and walk off because they're trying to passively send this message of hostility that I don't like the way you're treating me right now. It's not an effective way to do that. But they separate, and then this person, the preoccupied person, won't let them go or will get very upset or chase them around. And this is a flashpoint for violence. So we're hearing from the couple therapists that was a dynamic.
And I think he may have initiated it on occasions too, that I'm less sure on.
Okay, there was an important detail. According to her, she saw most of the time, if not all the time, the violence was initiated by Amber Heard. She says maybe some of it was initiated by Johnny Depp, but I'm less sure about that. It says a lot. Now, of course, what Dr. Hughes would say is, you're not an expert in that, or at least you haven't demonstrated expertise in that. You didn't provide any formal assessments, and you only had a certain amount of sessions with them, and that the assessment of that probably wasn't the primary focus. You're trying to help them with their conflict. You're not necessarily trying to determine who's to blame. You're going off of their account of things. But I will say, this is significant. This testimony is significant. She doesn't, I believe, have any reason to be biased towards Johnny Depp or Amber Heard. And according to her, and she seems quite relaxed as she's giving, this is the sort of testimony that I would give when I would be called into court. I didn't have a stake in any of it, so I would just answer freely and didn't care about what the consequences were. I mean, that's funny. I wouldn't say that. But I wasn't worried that by telling the truth, somehow I would be harming my career or something, right? The way that a forensic psychologist might worry. If they say something that helps the opposition, they might not ever get hired again. So I was more in this style, kind of like, I don't know. I kind of feel like, because I didn't want to spend hours prepping.
And how did you come to the understanding that on some occasions Ms. Heard physically abused Mr. Depp?
Ms. Heard reported that.
What did Ms. Heard report to you?
That it was a point of pride, two things. It was a point of pride to her if she felt disrespected to initiate a fight, and was her father had beaten her, she was not going to. And the second...
Okay, I think someone objected and interrupted her, but wow. Wow. I mean, I'm stunned at what she's saying, and she seems credible, does she not? Because she's not on either side. And I can see why Dr. Hughes, if she wants to put forth a particular thesis, would not want to talk to her, because this sounds credible, that according to her, Amber Heard told her that it was a point of pride for Amber Heard that she could provoke, let's re-listen to that, and get Johnny Depp to get in a physical fight with her, because she was about to say she was abused when she was a kid, and, you know, I don't know where that was headed, but you could imagine a conceptualization of, well, one, violence is normalized for you. Two, you might have observed that in someone else when they didn't want you to separate. They would provoke to create chaos, and people will do that. And a minority of borderline individual will do that as well. Not everyone, but they, you know, the abandonment trauma is so severe, and the fear of being left alone is so severe that it will eclipse all other reason that the individual has. And so in the moment, you're just saying, I can't deal with this. And you're either shutting down or you're moving away. And the borderline individual is just so threatened by that, they will do anything to get you to get a feeling back that you're engaged with them, that you are interacting with them, even if it is contentious. They would rather have you fighting and yelling and maybe even being violent than you walking out the door without knowing that you're coming back. Of course, you are going to come back, unless you're saying you're not, but you probably, you know, these kinds of fights, someone walks away. But they'll do anything, and they learn over time that, well, if I poke this thing, it'll get them to engage. And I don't know about Amber, but I do know that for some people, suffering from borderline will be so good at pushing people's buttons. It's a minority of people with borderline, but many people with borderline share this characteristics of they know exactly how to get under your skin, including myself as a therapist. I was working with someone that had this condition, and I hadn't really developed a conceptualization of them yet or a diagnosis yet, so it was early in treatment. But I won't go into details, but in at first she was attacking me, but I started to think, oh, verbally she's attacking me. And at first I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And I just addressed it. I was saying things like, yeah, okay, I understand. She was essentially criticizing me, and yeah, okay, you know, maybe I made a mistake, or, you know, let's talk about it. Or I'm human, and I'm trying my best, and sometimes I make the wrong call. You know, it wasn't like a specific criticism. It was kind of global about me as a human being. And, you know, I was probably 10, 15 years into my career and felt confident as a therapist, and it didn't rattle me at first. I said, you know, and it went on for 5 minutes, and then another 5 minutes, and then another 5 minutes. And I remember thinking, okay, I think I know what's going on. There's something going on characterologically with her, personality disorder-wise, and so I'm just going to frame it that way, and, you know, I'll listen and I'll remain in contact, but I'm not going to take this personally because I don't think there's any legitimate reason for the, you know, the amount of energy that she has around this. And I also thought that her criticism was legit to some extent. And I was even agreeing with her. I was like, yeah, you're right. I probably should have done this and that. But it wasn't like an egregious claim against my professionalism. But then at like the 15, 20 minute mark or something, she started to weasel her way into my personality, past the defenses past my professional shield. And I had a full-on panic attack. I mean, it was like she, you know, I kept, you know, but my heart starts to pound, my head starts to sweat. I start to have this desperate desire to run out of the office. I'm like, I never want to see her again. I never want to be a therapist again. And I can't think straight, and I'm starting to get dizzy, you know, full on just anxiety attack. And this doesn't happen very often. In fact, this probably is the worst by far manifestation of that experience in therapy. And when I did my dissertation on difficult moments in for therapists, I thought about myself, and I thought, well, what's a difficult moment for me? And this is the one that came to mind. So I wrote a lot about it. But anyway, I interviewed a lot of other seasoned therapists about their difficult moments, and they were often kind of similar. Anyway, but looking back, I just thought it was masterful. And I've seen this before, personally and professionally, people with borderline have this, not all of them, but you know, a minority of them have this really good way of just like knowing exactly what to say to get under your skin. And it went obviously straight to my core. I mean, she didn't just kind of get in there. I mean, she got deep in there, and she didn't know anything about me. You know, it wasn't one of those situations where she had things to go off of. She didn't have really much to go off of. But that's the thing about people with this condition, is that depending on their defenses within borderline, they might learn that, again, any contact is better than no contact. And if I went through abuse, I kind of have an inner abuser, and I want to abuse other people. So there's that manifestation of, you know, the projective identification aspect of it. And the skill that they learn from a very early age is very quickly evaluating, sometimes below the surface, subconsciously, the weaknesses and the sensitivities of other people. And they almost, without trying, know how to get under people's skin within a few minutes of talking to you. And they're not scheming, they're not psychopaths, but it's important to them to notice, because they believe they need to know that information if they need to use it in the future, right? So, but anyway, let's rewind this. And I'm not saying that any of that is Amber, but yeah, I'm astonished at this. This has a lot of weight, actually, because it's so specific, and it's direct words from Amber, right? So let's rewatch this.
And leave was her worst nightmare, and I think he may have initiated it on occasions too, that I'm less sure on.
And how did you come to the understanding that on some occasions Ms. Heard physically abused Mr. Depp?
Ms. Heard reported that.
What did Ms. Heard report to you?
That it was a point of pride, two things. It was a point of pride to her if she felt disrespected to initiate a fight, and was her father had beaten her, she was not going to. And the second one is what she reported to me, which is if he was going to leave her to de-escalate from the fight, she would strike him to keep him there. She would rather be in a fight than have him leave.
Right. So Amber, at this point, by this point, had been in a lot of therapy, I believe, or just knew this about herself, because that's her admitting. I'm just going to take a guess and say Amber, to Dr. Anderson, didn't say, I approve of this behavior, that when he wants to leave, then I'm proud of myself. Well, she basically even said that. She said, Dr. Anderson said that Amber Heard had as a point of pride. So I guess she was proud of it. But either way, we're hearing that Amber Heard disclosed openly to Dr. Anderson that when Johnny Depp was distant or wanted to separate, that she was proud of herself, that she knew how to manipulate him into a physical altercation. I mean, she didn't say specifically physical altercation, but I think that's essentially what she's referring to. And as a matter of routine, that's how she handled that, because she was so desperate for being alone. Wow. I mean, wow. So can there be incidents of Johnny Depp being coercive towards her as well, or even overall. Yes, given that, yes. But those statements from someone who observed them, the jackhammering, the rapid fire, not letting him have a voice, I'm proud of myself that I know how to provoke him into a physical fight because I'm desperate not to be alone, and I don't want him to have the freedom to leave an argument with me. And we heard from the sister that he would go into his own bathroom in his own house to, I'm guessing, to lock the door and just be alone and get away from her. That does not sound like victim behavior from Amber, right? It could be that it's mutual abuse, but it doesn't sound like a victim. It could be, you could conclude that, but it doesn't sound like that.
In the first session, just how bad the relationship is, just how mean they are to one another. And at that point, because I'm typing quickly as they go along, I'm switching into a different voice, more about the process between them, where she has, I believe, interrupted him. He says no more about what she says about him. And it's just that they're fighting and she has a hard time. She bites the bait. She can't let him talk, is my recollection. And from this, that's kind of what that is. So it gives me a sense of what they're doing at home. They're each reporting. This is what we say to each other.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Okay, last professional bit here. She said earlier, I don't think I included it, that she writes her clinical notes during the session, which a lot of people will do. I don't recommend people do it because if you're going to be really listening, it could interfere with that. Now, of course, I will take notes, usually in the very beginning of the first couple sessions, but to do that every single time could make treatment a little bit harder, particularly if you're doing it throughout the session. You know, there's a different mindset of like, oh, I'm listening, I'm being compassionate, I'm evaluating, I'm trying to picture what's going on, I'm trying to help. That's a different mindset to, okay, what do I need to type such that I am following my ethical guidelines and I'm also providing me little notes to remind me of what happened at this moment. It's a very, very different mindset, right? Now, I don't know, maybe for her, she's really good at it. She can do both those tasks well. Maybe she only does the typing thing mode very occasionally. Who knows? But you know, I don't recommend people do that unless they absolutely know that it they can manage it. Because you know, a lot of people think they can multitask when they can't. And imagine that you're talking to your therapist in session and you're getting into some really heavy stuff and they're like, oh, okay, yeah. I wouldn't feel good about that. So again, note-taking is a different kind of thing. It's there's similar risks to note-taking of you're listening and then you just start writing things down. But every session. Now, the reason why she says she did it is because she said she would be writing her notes for a long period of time every day if she waited until after sessions to write her notes. And I absolutely sympathize with that. It can be a hardship for therapists to keep up with their session notes, particularly at the end of the day when you just want to go home and have dinner. And I get that. But the solution to me, for me, actually, is learn how to take notes very, very quickly. Literally within 15 seconds, I have a system where I can very quickly document what happened in the session. Is it very detailed? No. Now, I don't have clients where I need to be very detailed, but you know, it's detailed enough, and there's that. So anyway, that's the last little professional bit that I will say. They just got into interpreting the notes. Dr. Anderson, and she was saying that she noticed that, well, let's rewind that. I think she was saying something like she noticed that Amber was over talking.
At any point during the first session, did Ms. Heard interrupt Mr. Depp when he was trying to talk?
Yes. She talked over him. She had rapid fire talking.
Right. There's that. reiteration of a frequent interrupting communication style and a rapid fire way of talking.
It's so when she said in terms of physical abuse that he hits her, a no closed fist means an open hand slap to me. And she says that she hits back and now she starts it and sometimes hits him first because her history is having been violated by her father physically. And just out of pride, she, if she's, a lot of things trigger her. And if she's triggered, she would hit him first.
Okay, a little bit more detail as she is explaining what her notes mean. And yeah, wow. It certainly sounds like mutual abuse to me, given what I've heard thus far, particularly from her. And she's telling us Amber's report. And as I said earlier, I have watched, this is like day three, I've watched like day 15 or something with Dr. Hughes, and you just have to wonder, like, was this considered? Because to get a statement from a clinician that Amber Heard said that it was a point of pride for her that she could provoke Johnny into being violent with her, it just seems like that would have been considered. And all of the self-reporting to the past therapist that you considered so strongly, and all the self-reporting from Amber that she reported in the evaluation and in the tests, it would seem like you would look for some other data that is coming from sources that might have had an opportunity to have a more accurate point of view. You just think that you would at least and maybe she did. Maybe I'm sure Dr. Hughes did consider it. It was data that I'm sure she reviewed, but yeah.
And the he you're referring to is Johnny Depp, correct?
Yes.
When you said that she sometimes hits Johnny first because of pride, what did you mean?
She was sensitive to feeling disrespected and a number of other things. And if she felt disrespected, she had come out of her background history feeling that her pride needed to dominate and she needed to stand up for herself.
Interesting. So we're getting a specific conceptualization that because she was disrespected in the past by her parents or her father, she was very sensitive and triggered when disrespected as an adult. And she also said a lot of things triggered Amber, but this is one of them, the disrespect, then that would justify hitting Johnny Depp, which, yeah, that's a common enough conceptualization or way of seeing why someone would believe that it's okay or justified, or at least in the moment, that they could be physically abusive to someone. That, again, I keep talking about Will Smith because I think it's a similar possible conceptualization. In brief, he witnessed his dad abusing his mom. He thought it was all his fault when he was a young child and convinced himself he's a coward, had a lot of trauma around that. Fast forward to an adult, he sees a man, Chris Rock, saying a joke about his wife, and it's not just Chris Rock, right? It's just like millions of people making fun of Jada Pinkett Smith and this urge to not be that coward, to fight back, to make it right. And now I have a chance because I'm tall and strong and powerful and rich and famous. So I'm going to walk up on that stage and I'm going to slap my father. I mean, Chris Rock, you know, that kind of thing. We could imagine, according to Dr. Anderson's conceptualization, that for Amber, it was a similar trauma of being a child and being disrespected and being harmed and abused. And all the time feeling like I'm a weakling. I'm weak. I'm a coward. I should have fought back. And, you know, that's one of the unfortunate things about being abused, that the victim will often blame themselves, which is just so tragic. So it's one thing to go through abuse. It's another thing to have the abuse get in your head where you think it's your fault. And yeah, it's just so tragic and I don't know, depressing to me to a certain extent. So for Amber, we could imagine that would be the case. Who knows? And then as an adult says, if anyone even slightly disrespects me, I'm going to stand up for myself. But if your version of standing up for yourself involves the things that were modeled to you when you were a kid, then you're going to be abusive, right?
When Ms. Heard told you that Johnny Depp hits her or slaps her, Johnny Depp was not present, correct?
Correct. Okay. And it wasn't plural. It was, she referred to, well, I wrote he hits her. Yes. So maybe it was plural.
But he was not present when she made that assertion.
He was not.
Did Ms. Heard tell you that she socked Mr. Depp?
Yes. She was describing kind of the progression of the physical violence.
Did you have any understanding of what she meant when she admitted that she socks Mr. Depp?
Yes, because there were three lines above this that explained the progression a bit. And I've already said what it was. She felt she had to hit him back if he hit her. And so she always did.
Okay, a little bit more detail. She stated she had to hit him back if he hit her. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like a lot of violence between the two of them, and almost, at least from Amber, a policy that's what she does. It wasn't an anomaly. It wasn't regretted. It was a decided policy. So this therapy is happening in 2015, and the May 21st incident was in 2016 when Johnny Depp said allegedly that he wanted to leave her, and then allegedly she became violent with him. So what the couple therapist is saying right now, actually, when I think about it, is very emulative of at least what Johnny Depp's lawyers are saying, is that she, Amber Heard, has a policy of violence when Johnny would ask to separate physically or otherwise, and to want a divorce is the ultimate separation, and then she has a policy of being violent. We don't know if that policy was at play in that moment, but it certainly plays into the Johnny Depp narrative. But it's interesting to me that just a year prior to divorce, I think the official divorce was in 2017, but their agreement to divorce was in mid-2016. And it's interesting to me that just a year prior, they were trying to make it work, and Amber Heard was disclosing a lot to the couple therapist, seemingly not to cover her own butt, as we say, meaning that Amber Heard was telling the couple therapist things that would be condemning to her, probably because she wanted to be honest and she was actually trying to improve their relationship, which of course you would want to do in therapy. And it just makes you wonder, when the time came that she realized that maybe the relationship was over, when Johnny Depp said he wanted a divorce, that, again, this is complete speculation, there'd be no way to know this, but it could play into the Johnny Depp narrative that at that moment she starts to reflect back, oh my God, I mean, there's this long trail of evidence that I was violent with him, and if he comes out with that, that will be humiliating to me and could end my career. So I've got to get out ahead of that and present my side. And then she talks with her friends and family, and they kind of feed into it, and then you start going down a road, and then you end up writing a piece in the Washington Post. I don't know. It's notable that a year before they split, Amber Heard was being that honest with the couple therapist. I think that's notable.
Doing a lot of, he was fucked up, as she would say, on a lot of drugs, and she slapped him because he was being incoherent and talking about another, being with another woman.
Okay, another incident that I think was reported by Amber Heard, that Johnny Depp was very intoxicated and talking about being with another woman, probably in the midst of a conflict, right? It's not like I highly doubt Johnny Depp just woke up in the morning and said, I'm going to try to hurt my spouse. It was probably mutual jabs, verbal jabs, hurt, triggering. And you just have to wonder about his drug use back then, if it was a part of, obviously it was a part of it, but if it was intertwined in this, that it was a way that he could escape without physically being gone. Anyway, but I think his drug abuse predated Amber Heard, or I imagine it did. Anyway, and then Amber strikes him because he said that. So, yeah, I mean, I'm guessing y'all have watched this because it was a couple weeks ago, and you've already been down the road of like, wow. But, I mean, wow.
Did she tell you that he had hit her first, or was she the one who initiated the slap?
She initiated that one because I think she felt demeaned and threatened.
And
I'd love to hear Dr. Hughes's opinion on that. How do you explain that? How do you explain everything that she's saying? How does that fit? You know, of course, what she would say is either I discount everything that that therapist is saying because I think that she's biased, or the account was wrong, or the notes are wonky, so how can she possibly remember exactly what was happening? Or she would say, well, yeah, in the midst of an overall coercive, abusive, controlling, intimidating, threatening relationship by Johnny Depp, there were occasional bad behavior from Amber Heard, and that was an example of that. But it's hard to characterize it that way, given what we've seen so far.
What did you mean by that?
She loved him. He loved her. She believed that she wasn't stupid. She knew that what they were doing wasn't healthy. And so she wanted to divorce him, but she didn't.
Interesting. Makes sense. Common that a year before divorce, Amber Heard is reporting that she recognized that their relationship was unwell, and she wanted to divorce, but she loved him as he did her and did not want to leave him. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a part of this that I'm glad is being discussed here, because from the outside, it might just be like, what are you people doing? When you're in love and you're super attached, that's how it is, right? You'll put up with a lot. So that's what drew them together. Probably a lot of good times, a lot of attraction, a lot of laughter, a lot of warmth at times. So, yeah.
Do you recall the names of any of her entourage?
One was Rocky.
Directing your attention to the last snippet from that session, will she have advantage if she leaves him but files with police for abuse first? Was that a question that she asked you?
Yes, this was her talking out loud, trying to strategize for herself.
Wait, what? I wish she would have allowed... Let's rewind that.
Do you recall the names of any of her entourage?
One was Rocky.
Directing your attention to the last snippet from that session, will she have advantage if she leaves him but files with police for abuse first?
So, according to the couple therapist, in an individual meeting with Amber Heard, she said, will I have an advantage if I divorce first and file with the police that I was abused? Okay, so on the surface, that doesn't look good for Amber Heard, right? That she's strategizing not from a place of wanting to call the police for safety, but because she wants to get back at him or is looking for some sort of public persona or image that she wants to put out there, wants to control the narrative. Will it be better for me to do that? On the other hand, if she is someone that's being abused, which we could argue, you know, that she is someone being abused because they're both abusing each other, possibly. That's one way of characterizing what we've seen thus far. And she is sitting there saying, well, yeah, it's probably occurred to me that I would call the police, but and I have at times, but I don't want to because I want to try to work this out. We're in couple therapy. I'm trying to help us out. So I don't want to go to that extreme. But if we're going to divorce, then I will finally, because he deserves it. He's a perpetrator, and I'm going to finally get justice for this. You make the call as to which one that is.
She reported always hitting him back as a point of pride, but admitted that she eventually initiated the hitting herself. Is the she you're referring to, Ms. Hurd?
It is.
All right, well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.